From KALW in San Francisco, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, where you join journalists in a critical conversation about the week's news. At 9 o'clock a.m., Donald Trump officially became the 45th president of the United States. Donald Trump is taking office with the lowest approval ratings in modern times. Hillary Clinton received 2.86 million more popular votes than Trump, but Trump got 306 electoral votes to Clinton's 232. This morning, the BBC reported that there are more police than spectators in Washington, D.C., and protests began earlier this morning in D.C. and around the globe. Tomorrow, the Women's March in D.C. has spread to 60 countries around the globe. Marches will be taking place all over the world in places like Iraq, Kenya, and Peru. Well, joining us to talk about reaction around the globe and media coverage of the nomination hearings this week are three journalists. Sarah Jaffe is a writer with In These Times and the co-host of Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast. Sarah focuses on labor, social movements, gender, media, and student debt. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. I'm actually not a writer with In These Times.
Oh.
That has not been correct for a couple of years, although I do occasionally still freelance there.
Okay.
I'm a reporting fellow at the Nation Institute.
All right. Well, thank you for that correction, and thank you for joining us. We're also joined by D.D. Guttenplan, the Nation's editor-at-large. His book, American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone, was awarded a prize for biography. He also produced the acclaimed documentary Edward Said, The Last Interview, and wrote and presented War, Lies, and Audio Tape, a radio documentary about the Vietnam War for the BBC. Hi, D.D. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. And just for your listeners' edification, I'm at large at the moment from London.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for joining us from London. And we're also joined by Eileen Track. She's a Mexican journalist and author of Dreamers, The Fight of a Generation for Its American Dream, Migrant Journeys. Hi, Eileen. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, Sarah, let's start off with you. What caught your attention this week?
Yeah, my friend David Dayan had a wonderful piece up at the Intercept looking into would-be Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin's foreclosure machine and the question of whether or not his bank should have been investigated and possibly had charges filed by the California State Attorney General's office.
And so what stood out for you in that story?
I mean, first of all, it's kind of got an amazing backstory where they found out about this because an anonymous package of documents was mailed to David and a few other people that showed that within the Attorney General's office, within Kamala Harris's office, there was investigation into this bank that had been going on for a while. They had recommended that that investigation officially begin, that there was a lot of you know, demand within that office for something to happen, some consequences for this bank for what they were doing, which I think most of your listeners are probably, you know, now familiar with.
Right. And that came out actually last week. Another listener brought that up because there's a California focus to that. And
right, exactly.
Sarah, since you brought up Steve Mnuchin, just overall, because there were so many nominations this week, I mean, it was hard enough for journalists to keep up with this, let alone people who have jobs.
Yeah.
What did you think of coverage specifically of Steve Mnuchin's nomination and the hearings?
You know, one of the problems that I've been thinking about a lot is that the sort of mainstream media that abides by these ideals of objectivity really is not prepared to deal with people who just sort of lie cheerfully, or just are completely prepared to sort of flout any sort of rules and regulations that exist. So, like, one of the big stories that came out of Mnuchin's hearings was that he forgot about $100 million in assets that he has. I can't imagine having enough assets to forget about $100 million worth of whatever it is that he had that he didn't report on his taxes. And so when you look at things like this, you look at sort of Donald Trump's willing ability to not, or yeah, willingness to just lie to people, I should say. There's a real difficulty in the kind of press coverage that we normally get, which is like, well, Donald Trump says this and other people say this, and or, you know, Steve Mnuchin says this and other people say this. It really doesn't work with this, certainly now this president, and with many, many of the people that he's appointed to his cabinet.
Well, we will put a link to that story on our website right after the show. That is Sarah Jaffe. She's a fellow at the Nation Institute. And what about you, Don? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I want to pick up on something Sarah said, because I think it's absolutely right that we've been the sort of mainstream objectivity on the one hand, on the other hand, model of journalism is so obviously broken by what we're seeing now. And there's been a kind of progressive desensitization, or I guess you could call it normalization, where it's like the outrage du jour is only succeeded by the outrage of the next jour. And after a while, you sort of feel like the media fails to realize that this is like a huge change. It's a huge change in standards of public life. It's a huge change in the way our government functions. It's a huge change in what we're supposed to expect from our public officials. And, you know, the kind of people dead. I mean, when Elizabeth Warren asked the nominee for education secretary whether she's ever been to a public school, sent her children to public school, set foot in a public school, and answered all those questions is no. Mm. You know, it's like our language is, in a way, failing to encompass the degree of radical break with the past that we've just seen. So I think that's something that all the press has been struggling with. And on the other hand, as a reader, I find the kind of, you know, cabinet outrage nominee of the day coverage depressing and also dispiriting and also in a way delusional, because there's almost the sort of like a naive faith that if you just tell people that these people are deeply conflicted, something will happen. And so far, nothing is happening, and I guess that's what stuck out for me this week was actually a piece, and I know, you know, I feel slightly guilty promoting my own shop, but it's not my own piece. It's by Fran Piven, and I actually loved it enough to send her somebody I've never known or met fan mail. She has a piece in The Nation called "Throw Sand in." I think it's called "Throw Sand in All the Gears." I'll give you the exact title. "Throw Sand in the Gears of Everything," and it's essentially about how, what it's going to take to stop things, what it's going to take to slow down and derail this machinery of repression that we're seeing assembled, and that it's, you know, the kind of getting out and protesting is great and it makes us feel better, but it's not going to stop things, and it's going to take a lot more to stop things. And I felt like it was, as I wrote to her, the first thing I've read that didn't seem in one way or another delusional, because it was just very wise, sane, and clear.
Wow. Well, we'll bring that to the table on Monday, because we're going to do a show then about all of the protests that are happening over the weekend. That is D.D. Guttenplan, who also goes by Don. He is The Nation's editor-at-large in London. And what about you, Eileen? What did you see this week that stood out?
Hi. Well, let me tell you that we have been reading and listening a lot of analysis, mostly in the national level, trying to understand or to, to explain and to foresee what's going to happen during a Trump administration. But this Sunday, the LA Times ran a story that caught my attention, because Eben Halper, who is a reporter that now is in Washington, but in the past, he covered the campaign and the government of Arnold Schwarzenegger in California. So what he did is a piece comparing, the name of the piece is Reality Lessons from a Celebrity. And what he is doing, I think he started off out of this exchange that Donald Trump and Schwarzenegger had on Twitter. And what he does is kind of a review on what happened when Arnold Schwarzenegger ran for governor, when he won, what kind of environment was around him, the tone of his speech, and how all of these partnership start to fade once he was in office, and once people, even people who was very empathic with him, started to realize that California had very large problems at that moment, that not everything was going to be solved just because the governor was going to say so. He goes through the path that Schwarzenegger went during that time, and at the end he says, you know, he at some point realized that he had to start fixing his mistakes, talking to people, not only rely on popularity, and he was forced to reevaluate his entire approach to California. And I think this piece is very interesting at this moment, because I hope we can say something about Donald Trump in the near future. I think that idea of starting to, you know, just step into the reality and trying to look for a way to actually work with the people, listening to the people, it's something that he can learn from many others, including those who have been stars previously than politics. And also, very quick, I want to mention a piece. You know that sometimes I like to mention journalism that is being made in Spanish, and I like very much Radio Ambulante, this independent project. And a few days ago, they put to air a piece by Valeria Fernandez, this immigration reporter based in Arizona. The name of the piece is El Vacío, The Void. The transcription and the translation in English is available in the Radio Ambulante website. And Valeria Fernandez talks about her visit to southern Mexico to visit Central American children that are detained by immigration authorities there. Children are looking to get to the United States. And I think this is a very good moment as well to listen to that piece, because I'm a little bit concerned that with the tone that Mr. Trump has used around immigration based on security issues, political issues, we are forgetting about the human rights and the social justice face of the immigration. And these kind of pieces, I think, are very needed at this time.
Right. And all week we've been doing shows about President Obama's legacy. And yesterday we focused on immigration and what he is leaving for Donald Trump. And you can find that show at yourcallradio.org. That is Eileen Two Rocks. She is a journalist. She writes for many Latin American publications. And she's the author of Dreamers, The Fight of a Generation for Its American Dream, Migrant Journeys. And we will put all of the pieces mentioned today at yourcallradio.org. And I also want to give out the phone number, because I know people have lots of emotions today. People are wondering what's to come. And I'd love to hear from you when you think about media coverage over the election season. A lot of the media, a lot of journalists said that they were going to do soul searching because they did not expect Donald Trump to win the Electoral College. And so what changes have you seen since the election? What's really stood out for you? And what did you think about the coverage this morning? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. I'd love to hear all of you as journalists talk about what's going through your mind and how you plan to cover the next 4 years. Don, you wrote a piece in the aftermath of the Brexit vote. And before Donald Trump won the Electoral College, you wrote, "To Americans tempted to think we are far too smart to be led astray in similar numbers by our own blonde demagogue, I can only say the British thought it couldn't happen here too, and it just did." So when you think about your role as a journalist over the next 4 years, Don, what really goes through your mind?
Well, I think two things. One thing is that although I suppose I can take some comfort in saying that I thought Trump had been consistently underrated and that there were none of the Republican contenders that I saw in any of the debates I went to and covered in The Nation seemed likely to be able to beat him, I was as surprised as everybody else on Election Day. So I think the first thing I need to take away, and I think a lot of journalists do, is quite a bit of humility and self-searching and trying to figure out what we've missed and to pay attention to the things that we didn't pay enough attention to see this coming. I mean, I thought that it might happen, but I didn't really believe it would. And so, you know, I wasn't paying enough attention either, and there are things I need to learn to pay attention to. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, I think it represents in some ways a bigger cultural change than a political change. I mean, the politics are going to be terrible, and the effect on the planet is liable to be terrible as all of these pipelines that Obama either delayed or stopped get approved. And, you know, as the carbon extraction industry goes into high gear, they're already, they're already firing up steel mills in Pennsylvania to make new pipe for pipelines. So, you know, that's going to be a really lasting and probably undoable effect of the Trump presidency. But the other political things, sometimes you can undo them, sometimes they can be delayed. So I think his biggest effect is probably going to be on the environment. But apart from that, there's this big effect on our culture, because here's this person that's done all the things that we teach our children not to do. You know, he's disrespected other people. He's denigrated expertise and experience. He's lied. He's stirred up hatred. He's disrespected people who are different from him. And it's paid off in the biggest possible way. So, you know, what does that say about our country? Well, I think that's going to take a lot of coming to terms with. And I guess my way of doing that as a journalist is to try and figure out where the most useful, productive acts and movements of resistance are happening, and to try to be there and amplify what they're doing.
What about you, Sarah? I mean, you focus on labor, social movements, student debt. I mean, you talk to people out there who are really struggling. What's going through your mind, and you know, what your plans are as a journalist over the next 4 years?
Yeah, I should say that I also didn't think Donald Trump would win, although I think that largely, as you've been saying, Donald Trump won the Electoral College, and if the Clinton campaign had not sort of overestimated their own abilities, we wouldn't be in this situation to begin with. But I would have said that states like Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania were absolutely vulnerable to someone like Trump, because those states have elected people like Scott Walker and John Kasich over and over again. And what we're likely to see on a national level is basically what's been going on in those states, and not enough journalists go to those states. Not enough journalists talk to people who aren't already in government or in media or in seats of power. And so I think that, and this is sort of a thing that I've seen a lot of hand-wringing around from folks in the media since the election anyway, which is like, oh my God, we didn't realize that people were screwed. And it's like, well, some of us have been telling you that for a long time, right? And that not only that, but it's in places like the New York Times, in the mainstream media, they've been running stories and graphs and charts that will tell you about things like the divergence of productivity from income gains for working people. It's not like any of this was a secret, but it still sort of seemed to escape people that when people feel really screwed and feel really ignored by the existing political establishment, they are attracted to people who appear to be outside of the political establishment. Now, of course, this week I talked to a guy who voted for Donald Trump. He's from Utah, and he believed that Trump was going to drain the swamp. And I met him standing in the rain outside of Goldman Sachs on Tuesday as part of a protest, because, of course, Donald Trump is not draining the swamp. He's putting the swamp creatures in charge. And so this man is already feeling the hashtag Trumpgrats, as people would say, and came to join a protest against him. So that kind of thing, being willing to sort of to listen to people like that and to understand both why they felt the need to vote for Trump and why they might then change their mind about him is going to be so important over the next 4 years.
And what about you, Eileen? Yesterday on our show about Barack Obama's legacy on immigration and what he's leaving for Donald Trump, we heard from a dreamer, and we talked about the fact that so many young immigrants are speaking out openly who are undocumented. We talked about what's at stake for them. So as someone who focuses on immigration and immigration rights, how do you see your role as a journalist over the next 4 years?
Well, it's going to be a very busy year for immigration journalists. And I think we're going to have many issues to talk about, but I think we should start focusing in listening people, listening more people than that we normally talk to, or we try to whose voices we try to put on paper, on media. Typically, immigration reporters here in the U.S. are focusing in going to immigrant communities and find those stories that are going to help to understand the wide audiences, specifically how these immigration decisions that are taken in Washington or in other offices are affecting real people in their real lives in our communities. And I think, I mean, that's our obligation. That's what we are supposed to do. But this time, I think we have to start giving information in order to end with the fear that we are seeing in both sides, not only in our immigrant community that, as you mentioned, right now feels very vulnerable. They have been under attack by the person who now has the highest position in our country. But also that kind of tone that Trump used during the campaign and after the election has also increased the fear that the other communities feel about immigrants. The omnipresent, they're still in our jobs. The idea that these people may be rapists or violent people. I mean, there are communities, of course, if you live in a city or in a community where you have a high amount of immigrant population, you may know that, no, they're not rapists, and maybe their children are sitting in the school next to your children, and you may be more familiar with them. But we have a lot of communities in the country that don't have that high amount of immigrant population, and we have to start listening to them as well. What do they think about immigrants? What do they fear about immigrants? It's because of their jobs. It's because of their security. It's because who their children are going to relate to. I think we have not done that kind of work in the past, talking to the other communities to understand how they are seeing us. And for me, that's something that I want to focus in during the next month. I report a lot in Arizona, in Texas, of course, in California, because we have large immigrant communities there. We're in the border, so every kind of issue affects us a lot. A lot of people, and in a high amount of issues. But we have other states where immigrants are not that large a population, and we don't go much over there, and we don't know much about how our immigrants are living there and how people are understanding immigration. If we want to start fixing things, if we want to start looking for what connects us instead of what divides us, we have to start doing that kind of job. And also, let me mention real quick, I also think that we have to follow what the Congress is going to do in that matter, because, Trump is now in the presidency, and he may not have a good idea about what to do to put people together, but the Congress does. You were talking about the Dreamers, these students that are in risk to lose DACA, and they're going to be vulnerable to deportation. But we saw in the last weeks that the Senate is already working in a new bill. The name is Bridge. Senator Durbin, who is the author of the Dream Act, is the one who introduced the bill. He presented it a few weeks ago. It's aiming to pass through Congress, not to a presidential act, through Congress, a way to protect these children for 3 more years. And the interesting thing to me is that this is a bipartisan initiative. It's a bipartisan bill. Republicans and Democrats are working on that bill. And I think that's the thing that we should be seeing in the future. We still have good people in both political parties. I hope Democrats start acting like Democrats and good Republicans remember who they are.
That is Eileen Two Rocks. She is a journalist who writes for a number of Latin American publications, and she's the author of Dreamers, The Fight of a Generation for Its American Dream. Sarah Jaffe is a fellow at the Nation Institute. She focuses on many issues, including labor and social movements. She's the co-host of Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast. Didi Gutenplan is the Nation's editor at large. And Didi, can you stay with us for about 10 more minutes?
Sure.
Okay, great. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and it's our media roundtable where you join journalists in a critical conversation about the week's news. And today we are joined by Sarah Jaffe, fellow at the Nation Institute and co-host of Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast. Eileen Two Rocks is a journalist who writes for various Latin American publications. She's the author of Dreamers, The Fight of a Generation for Its American Dream. D.D. Guttenplan is the Nation's editor-at-large and author of American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone. Wow, and if you need a book to read over the weekend, this might be one that would be really good for what we're dealing with right now. And D.D., I wanted to ask you before we let you go, when the Brexit vote happened, what did you see in the British media, and what has changed since that vote?
You mean about Britain or about the U.S.?
About Britain. Were they doing some soul-searching? Because so many British journalists also said they didn't see that vote coming.
British journalists don't tend to go in for soul-searching. So you didn't see a whole lot of that. I mean, there was a certain amount of, oh my gosh, the polls were really wrong again, because the polls also predicted that the Labour Party would win the election in 2015, and they didn't. What I saw was essentially something similar, which was a mainstream political discourse that completely ignored the economic reality for many people who were shut out of whatever bit of recovery has happened. And, of course, the recovery in Britain was thinner than the recovery in the U.S., and it was spread even more narrowly. It was really concentrated here in London and the southeast of England. And it left the north of England pretty much behind. So what you had in the Brexit vote were the industrial areas of Britain voting overwhelmingly to leave. And then you had kind of cosmopolitan liberal London voting to stay. And you had a similar dynamic in the U.S., where if you look at sort of the Ohio-Pennsylvania border, I mean, I thought Sarah made a really good point about, in general, the press not spending a lot of time outside of the kind of coasts and shining cities. But I spent quite a lot of time in Ohio in the fall, and indeed, in Ohio at least, I expected that Hillary Clinton would lose. But I didn't. I suppose I believed the polls about Pennsylvania and other states, but. If you look at the Ohio-Pennsylvania-West Virginia border, that's an area that Trump did incredibly well in and that had gone for Obama both times. So, you know, you could write that off as racism, but it's sort of difficult to explain why they voted for Obama both times. And I suppose what I saw was that people who were just desperate for change saw that one avenue that to change was closed to them, because Hillary Clinton was really just offering them four more years. And so they took the only door they could, which happened to be the door on the right. Mm.
Don, what are you working on right now?
I'm about to go back to Ohio, actually. I'm about to go to Youngstown. I don't know whether people noticed. You were sort of supposed to not notice, but on the day after the election, literally the day after the election, General Motors announced they were laying off the third shift at Lordstown, which is a storied plant in the history of American labor, and a place where a lot of people, Lordstown is just outside of Youngstown, and Trump carried that appellation part of Ohio overwhelmingly. So I'm going to see what people make of the new administration and what their expectations are, and also see whether GM, which isn't a little, it's not a company that you can push around as easy as Carrier, whether, I mean, it was interesting. If you listen to Trump's speech today, it was totally not the kind of unifying speech that, for example, George W. Bush gave when he was inaugurated, or that Barack Obama gave when he was inaugurated. It was a speech to his base, and it was a speech to say, you know, you people backed me because you were sick of the status quo in Washington, and I haven't forgotten you, and the nation heard you because you elected me, and they're going to keep hearing from you. Now, you know, none of his cabinet appointments square with that. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what he does to put any credibility behind that, but and particularly with the people who put the most faith in him. So that's where I'm going next.
Well, enjoy Ohio, and we'd love to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Sure. Great to be with you.
D.D. Guttenplan is the nation's editor-at-large in London and author of American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone. We're also joined today by Eileen Two Rocks, a journalist who writes for many Latin American publications. She's the author of Dreamers, and Sarah Jaffe. She's a fellow at the Nation Institute and co-host of Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast. She focuses on many issues, including labor and social movements. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on media coverage of Donald Trump this morning at 9 o'clock? He officially became the 45th president of the United States. He's taking office with the lowest approval ratings in modern times. So what do you make of coverage so far of Donald Trump and his plans? And then what are your thoughts about coverage that you heard this morning of the inauguration? And did you hear coverage about the protests happening in the streets? Let's go next to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. It's a good program, as usual.
Did we just cut off Max? All right. Sorry, Max. We had some phone problems. If you call back, we'll bump you to the front. Let's go to Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Well, I am very grateful for your programming. I hope you survive forever. You're the only radio station I listen to. Anything with NPR or BBC, that's it for me. So I'm very grateful for your programming.
Thank you.
In these times of crises, nothing else makes it, in my opinion.
Well, thank you for that. I know, Chris, actually, can you elaborate on that? You know, something that's really bothering to me is that people do not trust the media. And they tend to write off outlets because of, for example, Judy Miller at the New York Times. So can you talk about just, do you not trust other publications or what?
I think it's the way that it's portrayed. Obviously, Fox News, none of my friends, the people I know, listen to Fox News that much. CNN, which is basically the same thing. I think it's the hyperness of it, hyperactivity of the way they portray the news. Also, it just seems so, I can't take it. It's just unhealthy for me to listen to it. And I need a calming presence if I'm going to listen to news, particularly if it's grim. I need to. And BBC and NPR are that way for me.
Mm. So. Well, thank you so much for calling. Sarah, I wanted to ask you about this. I mean, you often hear that people just do not trust media, and they don't know what to trust. And I also like to make a distinction between broadcast, radio, independent, because, I mean, the broadcast media, it, like Chris said, is very difficult to watch for many reasons.
Yeah, it's been, I mean, this is a question that I've been thinking about since this election. One of the, you know, there have been a ton of different maps of, you know, this thing like the opioid epidemic or foreclosures or anything and how they overlap with the Trump vote. But the one I'm interested in is the decline of local newspapers and the Trump vote. Because when, you know, more and more, as I'm sure your listeners know, when local newspapers are declining, when there's no local reporter that people trust, they're turning to wherever they can find news, and some of that is reliable and some of that is very much not. And when the sort of when the existing mainstream media either ignores where you live entirely or it covers it badly or it, you know, everything is sort of he said, she said, and you can't figure out what's true anyway, then, you know, people are turning to whatever sounds true and sounds believable to them. And that, you know, that ends up with a lot of problems, and that happens on the left as well as on the right. I certainly noticed a rise in sort of very clickbaity websites that very much stretched the truth this election period, particularly around the primary, from people on the left as well. And so it's not easy to tell people how to figure out what's reliable news, because sometimes the New York Times and the Washington Post also get it wrong, and sometimes local bloggers who you've never heard of break really incredibly important stories. And so these are such difficult questions to think about as we go forward.
Right. And then Dee Dee was also talking about going places where journalists don't go. And the one thing that really frustrated me during the entire election is when, you name it, an NPR or a New York Times would go out into, say, a rural area or a more conservative-leaning area, they would get a soundbite from the person.
Yeah.
And that's it. And you just don't, you need to spend an hour sometimes with someone to really figure out where they're coming from, and then to ask them more questions. Well, where did that view come from? And did you know that's actually not true? Or did you know that your senator actually doesn't vote that way? I mean, a soundbite just doesn't give you anything.
Yeah. Yeah, and they, you know, you sort of get people parachuting into places once every 4 years and talking about them as though they're these weird, exotic, you know, locations that it's not quite how it works. And I spent a bunch of my life living in South Carolina, in Louisiana, in Colorado, although I guess Colorado is sort of safely in the blue state column now. But when I was there, it was still one of those places where reporters would show up and everything was very strange. And these people have a lot of guns. What's going on here? And that kind of treatment doesn't do anybody any favors. And so, you know, this is what local reporters do well, is they know where they're coming from, and they know what their, they know what their town is like. They know the problems. They know the questions that people are asking. They know when the plant closed down and who lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing is really, again, it's just falling apart with the decline in local media.
And Eileen, what is it like in the immigrant community, say, when the national media does interviews with people about Trump's comments about building the wall or about the horrific things he has said about Mexicans?
Well, that's exactly the same thing that has been said so far. This parachuting formula happens as well with immigrant communities. I mean, I think one of the problems that we have in media when we are speaking about immigration and immigrants is that we tend to link immigrants with crisis or with problem. Traditionally, mainstream media, English language media, tends to cover immigrant communities when something is happening. Immigrants are being threatened by certain legislation, or students are going to lose their DACA. There's some kind of issue in the border. There's a hate crime. We tend to cover these communities because something breaking news is happening. And that's when we go there, and that's when immigrants go to the front pages or to the nightly news. So in the general imaginary, immigration equals problem, equals trouble, equals something that has to be fixed. And I think we have to make an extra effort talking about immigrants, not at this group that is having certain situation, but at these people that are part of our community. We can portray immigrants in our everyday lives, not going to the other extreme, that portraying this very successful immigrant who came to the country in poverty, selling oranges in the corner and now has a business. I mean, we see a lot of that as well. And that doesn't help much either. But we have to start talking with our immigrants who are part of the American people. Many of them voted, and, you know, especially with the Latino community. How is it that a Latino, and you can add here whatever you want, voted for Trump, thinks about healthcare, this and that? Well, you don't think as a Latino when you're going to vote. You think as people living in the U.S. with the same concerns that the rest of the other people living in the U.S. has in mind when they're going to vote. What's going to happen with my children if they want to go to college? How am I going to pay my mortgage? What's going to happen with my health care? We have to start seeing immigrants as regular people, because they are. We have more than 25 million immigrants working in the U.S., in the workforce. So let's start talking about them. As we talk about any other workers, let's talk about the students, not only the undocumented that went to Harvard and this and that. Let me give you one example. We have DACA in action now. It's been on for 4 years, and an estimate of 700,000 young people has been benefited by DACA with a temporary work permit and a temporary social security number. 90%, more than 90% of them are in school or working. Do you know why? Because we invested in them. Many of them have been there from K to 12. So we invested in them. Now they're in college. Now they are working. And 6% of these DACA beneficiaries started their own businesses. They are giving work to other people. They're creating jobs.
And so, Eileen, let me ask you, because we're going to do a show about DACA soon, because so many students are speaking out. I wanted to ask you before we get back to calls, what does this, the election and Donald Trump's Electoral College victory look like in Mexico? How is it being reported in the Mexican media?
Mexico is in a very bad situation right now because its government is in a very bad situation. Recently, a poll stated that President Peña Nieto has 12% of approval among Mexicans, 12%, and it's still 2 more years to go. So the trust in the government is very bad. And if you add to that the dependence, economic especially, but in many other ways, that Mexico has on the United States, the situation is really bad. But what's been happening is that there are not many, there are, of course, some good reporters, good journalists that have been trying to go deeper. But I'm not sure that in Mexico, the media, the journalists are understanding the relevance of what a Trump administration can mean to the country in terms of trade in the economic area. And pretty much they focus a lot in the wall in the border and in deportation, which is, yes, a concern. But both things are already there. You mentioned that Barack Obama has done a highest amount of deportations in this country, and we already have a wall in the most important border areas. So there are deeper issues that we have been thinking. Mexico is going to be affected by that, and I think they're just starting to realize it.
Eileen Two Rocks is a journalist who reports for a number of Latin American publications, and Sarah Jaffe is a fellow at the Nation Institute. And we've got Max in Berkeley back. Hi, Max. Sorry about that.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. As I was saying very quickly, I heard one of your guests talk about, of course, the very difficult economic political situation we can expect, especially in the U.S. Congress. But he mentioned also the election being the reflection of change in the sort of the culture of the United States. And I'd like to mention very quickly, I read the foreign press, Le Monde, Libération, El País, and a good publication from Cuba, 14 Media, which is very good. And I follow a little bit the situation in Mexico. I'd like to add to that quickly. In Mexico, the peso has dropped in value. That has a huge impact on their imports. And, of course, the price of gas has been increased by the government. That has created a great deal of unhappiness. And in addition, there is a great deal of worry about Mr. Trump's intentions regarding the taxation of car imports from Mexico. The Mexicans produce 3 million cars a year. 80% of these cars are exported to the United States. The taxation would have a great impact on the car industry in Mexico, which is substantial. And of course, many of these cars are produced in factories owned by American interests. So they're very worried about that, and there is a great deal of anger. Of course, there is, in addition, the problem with the fact that the price of oil has dropped. That has had an impact on oil production in Mexico and all of that. And I found some interesting statistics. Mexico today imports about 50% of its petroleum products from the United States. And the low value of the peso has had an impact on that. So the situation is very, very edgy in Mexico. There's been a rioting in parts of Mexico, very, very serious. So I'd like your guest to talk some more about that, but she's done a very good job already. So I thank you. By the way, the foreign media, especially the French press, Libération and Le Monde, I think have done a better job of dealing with the candidacy of Mr. Trump. And I remember very well a comment made by Monsieur Védrine, who used to be the foreign minister of France under Chirac, I believe, who said that before November, before the election in November, that the electorate in the U.S. would not elect a woman after the electorate's experience with Obama. I found this very puzzling. The connection between these two really puzzled me, but the men saw something coming that I did not see at all. Hmm. Thank you very much. Huh.
Thank you so much, Max. Eileen, this is a huge topic. We don't have much time left, but we're going to do a show about it. But a brief response to Max.
Yes, I think he's right. The environment right now in Mexico is very volatile. You know, they're trying to fix economy by raising taxes and raising the price of the gasoline. And, you know, that really hit hard. We have seen a lot of demonstrations in recent years for several issues, human rights issues, political issues. But this thing about the race in the gasoline really hit. It was the drop. The final drop, and we have seen this instability in Mexico. I think we have a couple of hard years ahead for Mexican people, for the Mexican government that doesn't know very well how to deal inside the country and outside the country. Everybody has heard what has happening with Trump when he talks about Mexicans, and when he talks about Mexico, when he was a candidate, he went to Mexico, he met President Peña Nieto, they supposedly spoke about the border in the wall. At the end of the meeting, President Peña Nieto said that the talk was very nice, and they talk about the wall, and of course Mexico is not paying for that. And a few hours later in Arizona, Trump said, and Mexico is paying for the wall. So you see that there's no good relation starting there at this moment. And, you know, when you have a president that doesn't have the trust of their own people, it's very hard to negotiate with other governments, especially if you depend economically from that government. And that's the case in Mexico, U.S., so we are going to see a very, very hard moment. I don't know how the Mexican government is going to do this. And analysts back in Mexico are not very happy either. There's fear. Let's see how things develop, especially in the trade area, which is the most vulnerable area right now for Mexico.
Thank you for calling in, Max. Nice to hear your voice. Let's go next to Denny in Richmond. Hi, Denny. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose, thanks for your show.
Thank you.
I was actually embarrassed by the BBC coverage of the inauguration today. It seemed to be very pro-Trump and very celebratory. I understand that the change of power between different parties is an essential part of our government, but I felt that it was very unbalanced and pro-Trump and didn't give the opposition much voice.
And, you know, a few people at the station have been watching CNN all day and said that they did over 5 hours, they didn't see any protesters. Sarah, what are your thoughts? Did you listen to the radio or watch TV this morning?
No, I watched Twitter. I got up this morning and I made myself a Twitter list of people who were covering the protests in the streets, and that's what I watched this morning. And it was, I think, the best decision I could have made for myself and for the work that I do, right? My job is to cover the protests and the people and the workers in Minneapolis who are on strike against Home Depot, and they're calling it a strike against Donald Trump and what he stands for. Huh. And so that's what I covered today. That's what I watched today. And it's been fascinating, right? There were multiple blockades at multiple entrances to the inauguration site this morning. A Black Lives Matter group completely shut down one of the major entrances. A climate change theme protest shut down another one. several others managed to at least partially block the inaugurations. There have been marches all morning. It's been really incredible just to watch the breadth of it. And now the student walkouts started around noon around the country at the time that Trump was being sworn in places like Providence, Rhode Island. There's going to be a march in Altoona, Pennsylvania. So really looking at what's happening around the country in response to the swearing in. And then, of course, the picture that everybody is passing around is the comparison of the aerial view of the Washington Mall during the Trump inauguration and during the Obama's first inauguration, which is a very, very, very different picture. And so it's a good reminder that, you know, there this president, as Eileen was just saying about Mexico, this president does not have the support of the people in this country either, that Trump was sworn in with the lowest approval rating since we started taking these opinion polls. And so to look at that and to think about what that means for their attempts to govern is going to be really important going forward. You know, that we have a democracy that theoretically means the presidency and Congress take their power from the people, and if the people decide to take their power back, then things may look very different very shortly.
We're also getting word that protesters are blocking the Caltrain station here in San Francisco at 16th Street. This weekend, Sarah, we are going to see massive protests across the country and around the world. The Women's March is happening in D.C., and then women's marches all across the country. Yeah. I've been enjoying reading about the women's marches that have spread to 60 countries around the globe.
Yeah.
Erbil,
yeah.
Iraq, Kenya, Peru, I mean, you name the country, and there's going to be protests there. So
yeah,
in our final
minute,
Sarah, how do you think the media should cover these protests over the weekend?
I mean, so what happened with the Tea Party in 2009 is an interesting example, right? Because for once, the media actually paid attention to a protest movement and actually covered it as if it was something serious and done by serious people. And so that is how they should treat these protests. These are also being done by serious people who voted, in some cases by people who couldn't vote. The fact that, you know, again, that high school students are holding walkouts because they are going to live in Trump's America and they were mostly too young to vote for it. That people who are undocumented or felons who were denied the right to vote also are taking part in these protests. That there's a whole breadth of people who are getting activated right now who never have before. And those are the people whose opinion, again, as we were talking about talking to and trying to understand people who maybe voted for Trump, we also have to talk to and try to understand and not just get sound bites from the people who are standing up against him and taking various risks and putting their bodies on the line.
Sarah Jaffe is a fellow at the Nation Institute and the author of Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. We've also been joined today by Eileen Turok. She writes for various Latin American publications, and she's the author of Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream. Eileen and Sarah, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Helena Murphy and Stephanie Purcell are our volunteers. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.